So good morning, everyone. The morning talks are to focus on the technique, and therefore I will also devote this time a little bit more to yet another technique and to give a little bit of an overview of what we have been covering so far, maybe to refresh your memory, because there's a lot of information sort of coming in, I suppose, and if you are not so familiar with it, then it's maybe better to hear it again and again. So in short, what we've done so far is covering the metta bhavana is one technique, development of loving kindness, and we're doing that usually at the beginning of each meditation, but you could also do it at the end of a meditation, by the way. It doesn't have to come at the beginning. It may have the advantage that if you are in a busy surroundings and then you sit down for the meditation, that this good thoughts and engaging your thinking mind in a meditation object can help to slow down and to feel better and more calm as a preparation for the other meditations. So in that case, you could do it at the beginning, but it can be also done towards the end, like yesterday evening, at the end of the day, we did a little bit of metta bhavana. An interesting point, maybe you noticed, that I left out the north, south, east, west this morning, just in front of me, behind me, and in all directions, because sometimes we don't really know where is the north from here, for one thing. And then if you're in a new place and you don't know exactly its geographical situation, like you could, for instance, if you're in a familiar place, think of all the beings north of you, south of you, east, and even beyond the borders also, not just in the United States of America, but also in Europe and the Far East and so on. But that is maybe a little bit more cerebral activity than necessary. So if you leave out that north, south, east, west, you still cover all the four or eight directions or all around, near and far. Then it may be more realistic and also a little bit simpler. But that's the adjustment to the metta bhavana that we could make. And then we have talked about, of course, the anapanasati bhavana, the meditation on the development of mindfulness of breathing. And although I think I mentioned those techniques at the beginning of counting the breaths, for instance, we haven't really gone into it. I don't know whether you have practiced it or whether you are able to just come to the breath without the counting technique. I would say if you can get to the breath without the counting technique, it's even better, because the counting itself is a kind of artificial instrument to help you in a way to get closer to the breath and to stay with the breath, because you're sort of reminding yourself of it. But in the end, it becomes a kind of hindrance when you really want to feel the breath. Then the counting would come in the way of that as a kind of filter. So if you can do without the counting, it's fine. And if you really want to find out more about it, there are suttas or teachings on mindfulness of breathing where different techniques are still given for calming the breath and following the whole body of the breath, to become aware of the gaps between the breath and what to do. So those are more things, but I think a general awareness of mindfulness of breathing is good enough at this stage, and maybe even good enough forever. So then what did we have? The sweeping the body meditation, which comes under the feeling section in body, feeling, mind and mind objects of the four foundations of mindfulness. We call it vedana nusati, or the awareness of vedana, or feeling or sensations. We become aware of the sensations in the body. And I think it may be a good idea to practice one more time in a group, a guided sweeping the body meditation. I don't know how your experience was, but can be quite revealing in a way, and powerful, and even leading to very good tranquility. And hopefully also to insight, if you see the changing nature, the non-self nature of just feeling. So then we move on to yet another possible technique, if you want to call it technique. It is a word coined, I think, by J. Krishnamurti, but it can be very well applied in the Vipassana meditation, and that is choiceless awareness. Once when I used this word in some group, actually at a Krishnamurti school near Bangalore, and there was a professor of English, he said, the word choicelessness is not part of the dictionary. And I said, maybe it should become part of the dictionary. You know, it can. But okay, so choiceless awareness means that you are aware of things without picking and choosing, without clinging and condemning, without getting involved in all these things, just letting come, letting go, what we are already doing more or less, but as you know, a specific kind of attitude of your attention, not to get clinging to the pleasant, aversion to the unpleasant, or getting involved because it's so interesting, or so whatever, but rather having the attitude of a neutral observer. And the choiceless awareness can be used as a way of increasing your mindfulness in the present moment, because you're aware of everything. You allow the other objects also to come and go. It's not exclusive concentration on one thing and not allowing the other things or objects to come, but you just let them come and go choicelessly, without picking or choosing, clinging or denying, and things like that. No judgment, no evaluation, just the way it is, and the way that it comes, also letting it go. Therefore, I think perhaps in the second sitting meditation, after the walking meditation, we could do something like that, the choiceless awareness with a little bit of guidance to remind you from time to time. I don't know if the guidance is too much or too little or just right. It's difficult to say with a group of diverse people, but I hope it's more or less right and helpful. And if it's too much, then just treat it as hearing, 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 and forget about it. So, this is, you know, more or less the state of mind, the choiceless awareness, that one could get in as a kind of, stage of development, and a fairly well-developed state. If you are really in a state of choiceless awareness, there is no center from which you are observing or reacting, if you know what I mean. It is just pure awareness without any kind of me involved in it. If you are judging or clinging or condemning or evaluating or whatever, analyzing, then there's always a me, an I, or a center involved. And as long as there's a center, there will be a circumference. And when there's a circumference, there's definitely a kind of conflict between the inside and the outside, or what you want and what actually is. So to be without the center, in a way, and that, I think, is approximated by this choiceless awareness, is probably the ideal state of mind, if it is accompanied by right mindfulness, which it's supposed to be, actually, choiceless awareness from moment to moment. So then the things become clear one by one. Sometimes you may get these insights and then a little bit of a commentary in your mind. Aha, this is like it is, or something like that. A little bit of an analysis or some kind of a verbalization of what you just discovered. That's okay if it comes spontaneously. But I would say do not sit and try to analyze all these things that are happening and compare it with other experiences. Just let it be for what it is. So it's not so much referring to the past or to some other ideas that you may have, but just like that. Actually, the Buddha seems to have said, let the seen be in the seen, the heard in the heard, the smelt in the smelt, the tasted in the tasted, the thought in the thought, and the feeling in the feeling. Or first comes feeling and then the thought, in the order of the books anyway. So that means, without any kind of proliferation, what is called proliferation in Pali is papancha. Papancha is a process that happens very often, especially, you know, since we're brought up in a society where everything is supposed to be solved by thought and logic, and thought is sort of deified, you know, that is the ultimate thing that we have. You think, therefore you are, kind of thing. But the thought is not always the final solution or the final conclusion of what really is. So when you see something or hear something or, you know, anything through the senses, it's either a pleasant or an unpleasant or sometimes a neutral object. And with that, the natural tendency would be to cling to the pleasant and want more of it, and to avoid or have an aversion against the unpleasant and want less of it. But then there's a kind of a struggle between, and together with the clinging, you also get the fear of losing sometimes, you know. It's not just the clinging and the liking of it, but also the fear of losing. So that is what we call a proliferation, when you start comparing, judging, liking or disliking, then that is something extra that you add to the first experience of just seeing or hearing. But of course, if you don't compare, you might not even be able to recognize a thing. And that, of course, is not the idea behind this. If you see a rose, for instance, then immediately you see, oh, that's a rose. And then you maybe compare it to the roses that you've seen before, sort of in the background of your mind, and then you really realize this is a rose. But sometimes you're just looking at the images of the other roses rather than looking at the rose in front of your nose, so to speak. So, you know, the rose in front of your nose is the real thing that you're looking at. And very few people will really look at something or somebody the way it is or she or he is at that moment. They usually refer to it or to them, to experiences that they already had. And then they're really back in the past and judging from maybe pleasant or unpleasant experiences, and then not really seeing the person for what they are. So this being in the present moment and just experiencing something or someone as it is or as they are is an advantage to let go of the past, especially if it is an unpleasant past. Of course, everybody would like to let it behind them. Sometimes we like to think of the past when it was very pleasant, like thinking back to holidays or something like that. But in the mindfulness training, it is good if we can just be in the present without that proliferation going on. Maybe just to recognize something, of course, is necessary in order to function. Otherwise, it would just be color and shape, basically, not knowing what it is. That is becoming a bit difficult in that case to function in this world. So therefore, let it just be there for the comparison's sake, but not with the psychological background and all the imagery and feelings that may go along with it. So being more and more in the present can help us to let go of the burden of the past also. And that is one feeling of lightness, and you have more space to be in the present also when that happens. So the choiceless awareness, I would say, is a very good technique that we can just practice in a little while, actually, maybe after the guided sweeping the body meditation. What else? Maybe if you have a spontaneous remark or a question, that would also be okay. Fine. So, yes, please.
So with choicelessness or non-judging, in our daily lives, if we're confronted by something that is, let's say there's a crime or something terrible that happens.
Only seeing won't work, you would like to say. Is it?
So how do you deal with that?
Okay. Well, that's of course a very valid question. It's more or less like seeing the train ready to leave at Central Station and just saying, seeing, you know, lifting forward, blessing, and not catching the train. Yes, there are moral issues in that case also, like seeing a crime if you can prevent it, for instance, or should we not be moved by seeing something violent, or should we just be like a rock or a piece of wood, sort of, or like a zombie without any feelings? Well, I would say if there is something that you can do, now, you know, that is one of the problems, maybe, that in the case of a crime, the television gives you crime after crime after crime. It's like gossiping about this crime, that crime, you know. And there's nothing you can really do about it. It's just sort of entertainment in a way. But if there would be a situation where you can, for instance, prevent somebody from hitting or stealing something from another person, then yes, if you can skillfully intervene, then I would say, why not? But that is where we have to have this combination of what is called mindfulness and clear comprehension. Clear comprehension means within the context also, you know what's happening. Otherwise it would just be series of moments of just seeing without any kind of context, you know, it would be like a complete disintegration of the personality, maybe also just momentary moments of seeing, hearing. That's what's actually happening, but then it becomes impractical, and for practical purposes definitely you would need to know the context, and then what's good and bad also comes on top of that, you know, to choose for something skillful or good rather than the bad. So it's not that we, in that sense, don't react to anything. In that case it would be a reaction to something that is really unjust, for instance, and you do something about it. And of course, if you are a salesperson and somebody asks, you know, for something, and you just think hearing, and you just stand there, it won't work, yeah? So you have to do something about it, definitely. But when you talk about one aspect of it, sometimes we forget the other aspects, but it is a combination of a lot of things. But main thing is that we have our mind more free from the past and the future, at least from the psychological past and future. You know, there's nothing wrong with knowing your subject, what you're dealing with. Like, you're a doctor, you have to know your subject. Then an engineer has to know his subject, etc. You know, and even to know a language or the way back home from here, for instance, has to be somewhere within your knowledge. But not things like, oh, I should have done that, I could have done that, he did this to me, she said that to me, and repeating those kind of things. That would be considered, you know, unskillful, the psychological past, bringing it into the present without really being able to do anything about it. So in that way, to be free from the past and free from the future doesn't mean that you cannot remember anything or that you cannot plan anything also in that way. So then with the ethics together, I suppose then you will know what to do when the situation arises. Somebody once asked from an ex-Buddhist monk from Holland, he's not alive anymore, but what should I do when I meet a tiger? He said, where's the tiger? If you meet the tiger, you'll know what to do. But sometimes it's good, you know, to know, like if a car comes and is about to hit you, to just jump up, for instance, to know that may be a good idea. Yeah, you also had something. Sorry?
In a little more gray area.
Yes, that I understand.
One of the difficult practices is relationship to family.
Yes.
Your wife or your children.
The nearest and dearest is the most difficult, probably. And?
Well, you observe your children in a whole variety of situations. The choiceless awareness versus
How do you sort that out? Yeah. Well, I'm not Dr. Spock or anybody like that, you know.
There's so many people out there keeping absolutes.
Yeah. Well, I don't know whether he didn't give absolutely anything, I think. Just let them do whatever they want to do, you know, and give full freedom to the kids, and then wait and see what happens. And that Spock generation grew up, and they found their parents were too loose with them, you know, like they didn't do and they didn't interfere, they didn't give any guidelines, they were not strict, and they got a bit lost. And when they grew up, they become more strict to their children because they had missed what, you know, they were sort of expecting, maybe, or they could have expected from the parents. But to find the right medium solution, the middle way, between being too strict and too slack, yeah, is something that you probably only can realize yourself. Now, there are children of parents who are very, very strict. For instance, in China, in the traditional Chinese culture, the parents are usually very, very strict. And in some other countries too. And then you hear later on that, well, when, you know, they were very strict, we didn't like it at all, but now we appreciate it later on in life. So, but I suppose, you know, another good thing to keep in mind is that the reaction to that behavior of the child should not come from a personal anger or, you know, irritation, but rather from maybe, from well-being of the child in mind, and a skillful way of dealing with it. Now, if they really irritate you up the walls, so to speak, you know, then it could be that you feel like hitting them or something like that, or shouting at them or something. But that is not really a skillful way of dealing with it. So if you can look at yourself also and realize this is based on a skillful state of mind that I'm doing this, or this is based on an unskillful state, then perhaps you find the right way. If there's time for all that, it's like you have to have the good feeling, I suppose, for yourself. Fortunately or unfortunately, I don't have that kind of experience, so I cannot really talk from my personal experience in that case. But I must say, I do admire parents with very difficult children who keep their balance. Yes, please.
So is the technique for this more of the same kind of just being aware of when these feelings or thoughts arise and then letting it go?
Yeah. letting come, letting go, without getting involved. Now that, of course, you cannot really practice that exactly in daily life, as we mentioned, sometimes you have to do something, but here it is probably more like a training of, keeping balance and equanimity towards all these things. And probably, when you're meditating, 97.5% of the thoughts that come to your mind are not really necessary or relevant. You cannot do really anything with them. So it's a good idea to let them come and go. Sometimes you get carried away by your thoughts and you do this, you do that. So, most people's mothers would say, don't just sit there, do something. But the Zen master might say, don't just do something, sit there. And just sitting there and being able to observe these things coming and going makes you more free in your reactions, I suppose. You can go along with it or you can also not go along with it.